Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. The human heart is both a literal and literary miracle. As a solitary organ made of specialized muscle tissue, our hearts beat 100,000 times a day, or more than 2.5 billion times over an average lifespan. Poets, artists, and authors have rhapsodized about the heart over the centuries, giving us such images as broken hearts, hearts of gold, emotions from the bottom of our hearts, and of course, the cowardly lion who lacked a heart. My guest today, Dr. John Eleftheriades, has thought deeply about the heart in both literal and literary senses. He's the former chief of cardiothoracic surgery at Yale University, and in his 30-plus year career, he's operated on well over 5,000 hearts, including bypass operations, heart transplants, and complicated repairs of the aorta and other major blood vessels. He's the author of a new book, Extraordinary Hearts. Eleftheriades takes us through 10 different patient care stories, giving great detail about what it's like to be in the operating room and behind his surgeon's mask. At the end of each chapter, he reflects on each story's personal impact on him, taking the long view of his career, dreams, and world events at the time. I interviewed him from his home in New Haven, Connecticut. Dr. John Eleftheriades, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I want to start by asking you, what inspired you to write Extraordinary Hearts?
I had been very involved with literature in college at Yale, and I loved the written word. And I tested the waters a little bit with a couple books for the general public, one called Your Heart, an Owner's Guide, and then one called The Woman's Heart, an Owner's Guide, a few years ago. And then I had the great opportunity to meet and care for Robert Ludlum, probably one of the greatest authors of all time. And he encouraged me to write some fiction. So I wrote some fiction that came out about 2 years ago, and then I wanted to do a book to share some exceptional stories with the public, very, very moving stories of patients I cared for who enriched my life. And that's really what led up to this book.
They are indeed very moving stories, and you mentioned Robert Ludlum, who's, I would say, one of the two or three celebrity patients you've had, at least in the book, I imagine probably more throughout your career. What was his influence? He just encouraged you to try your hand at fiction?
I would sit by his bed when I was making rounds after caring for him. I cared for him twice, about 10 years apart, and I would ask him. I was fascinated by him. I remember the first time I walked up to his room to do my initial consultation with him, and I saw the name Robert Ludlum on the door. And I had, of course, read all his books. Whenever I traveled, I had one of his books on the plane with me, and I was just in awe walking in the room. And then as I cared for him and found that he was open to talking to me, I really foraged in his mind to try to learn about the creative arts and how he did what he did. And what he said basically was that a kernel comes into his mind, the kernel for a book, and then from there he sees it as very easy hanging characters and plot on different limbs of a coat hanger, is the analogy that he used. Now, something like that is easy for Robert Ludlum, but it's difficult for the average person, and certainly for a neophyte like myself. But the other thing he told me was that the most important part is knowing your subject. And he said that for a professional author to write, say, medical fiction, that author has to go out and have someone feed him information about the medical topic. He said the doctor's advantage is that you have all the information already, and then you just have to develop the story and get it on the page.
One thing I didn't know about Robert Ludlum was that he, I guess, is what you might call a bon vivant. He drank probably to excess. He certainly smoked heavily. And in one of the vignettes you paint, pretty much as soon as he had recovered enough to go to leave the hospital after his cardiac operation, I mean, it sounds like he got into a limo and had cigarettes and booze waiting for him. Did I get that right?
That's what the nurse told me. She took him down to the driveway of the hospital, and she said his limo was there, and they had the Johnny Walker Black, and they had a carton of unfiltered cigarettes, and a girlfriend there in the car. I can't attest to that myself, but that's what I was told, and those are the weaknesses to which I understand he was prone.
Do your patients, at least the ones that come to you before an operation, I guess my question is more of a clinical one, and that is, what kind of success do you have in getting them to quit tobacco permanently during or after their operations? Is he atypical? That's my question. Or is he sort of unfortunately more typical than someone who's very addicted to tobacco?
I think he's atypical in resuming the tobacco immediately. There may be something different about these highly creative people that the tobacco or the alcohol are part of the creative process. I don't really know. But for most of our patients, having to have your breastbone opened and go on the heart-lung machine and have an open heart operation, that usually deters one from smoking, at least for a period of time. I think for many patients, it's the last cigarette that they have before they come in the hospital. But to resume immediately, I would say, is very unusual.
Another famous person that you write about in the book was the jazz piano player Dave Brubeck. He had a coronary bypass operation, I think a three-vessel cardiac bypass, or what you relay in the story. Medical people call it a CABG, C-A-B-G, coronary artery bypass grafting surgery. And I guess the day after his operation on rounds, you went to his bedside and sort of you asked him, you know, Mr. Brubeck, how are you doing? And he said, chicken wire. And you were thrown for a loop because you thought maybe he was in some kind of brain fog. What did he mean by chicken wire?
I was really confused. And he saw the blank expression on my face. Just as you indicate, I was worried that something might be going on and he might be confused. But he was as sharp as could be. And I just had no knowledge of the music community. But what he explained to me was the following, that when his band was starting out, they would play in what he called dives. And it's hard to imagine Dave Brubeck playing a dive, but I guess at the inception of a career, even these great artists have to play small venues. And he said that after having the experience of having unhappy customers in the audience throw all sorts of articles up on the stage, he and his band learned to surround their band with chicken wire for their own protection. So he was telling me he had a pretty bad day with a little discomfort and a lengthy trip to the x-ray department and that sort of thing. And that's what he meant when he told me he had a chicken wire day. He was totally lucid, and I was the one who didn't have the background or experience to comprehend that beautiful expression.
So it's the medical professionals, as it were, that were throwing the objects at him sort of figuratively, the trips down to x-ray, etc.
Exactly.
I was wondering, Dr. Eleftheriadis, if you'd take us on a tour of something you refer to in the book as DHCA, which stands for Deep Hypothermic Circulatory Arrest. This is something I was maybe vaguely aware of, but even as a medical professional, I didn't have a great understanding. I was kind of very surprised to learn how long you can actually freeze somebody and operate on them without really any adverse effect on their brain or other organs.
It's really the most fascinating technique in medicine to which I've ever been exposed. It was developed in Siberia, where there is plenty of cold. And there was a very creative and courageous surgeon there, a cardiac surgeon, by the name of Michalkin, and he's like an unsung hero. But he would take little babies, and he would put them out in a snowdrift until their temperature fell very low and the heart stopped. Then he'd rush them into the operating table, make a small incision, and close small defects of the heart, like a hole between the chambers of the heart. He would put a couple stitches in, and then close up the heart and the chest wall. And then he would put the baby in a hot water bath, and then as the child warmed up, the heart would resume a beat, and these children would survive. And little by little, it spread to other more complicated operations. In the 1980s, an American surgeon, a pioneer by the name of Griep, G-R-I-E-P-P, at Mount Sinai, applied that technique to operations on the deepest, most recalcitrant, the most difficult part of the aorta, which we call the aortic arch. That's really, if the soul is anywhere, it could very well be there in that aortic arch. It's deep inside the body, and it carries branches that go to the brain and to the arms. and it's very difficult to access for replacement of the aorta. And Grief used this technique, and in this state of DHCA, or real-life suspended animation, the heart-lung machine was stopped entirely. So during that condition, there is no pulse, there is no EKG, there are no brain waves, and there's absolutely no blood flowing. So it's really indistinguishable from a state of death. And during that time, one can do an operation in that critical aortic arch area very quickly, and then using the heart-lung machine, warm the patient back up. And we have built a very, very, very large experience at Yale University, at the Aortic Institute, with that technique. And it's just fascinating to me that you can have someone in that state with no pulse, no brain waves, no blood flow, and then they wake up with all their knowledge and learned behavior, instincts, reflexes, completely intact. It's just fascinating to me. I have a video of a 78-year-old woman in whom we did one of these arch operations with about 40 minutes of circulatory arrest. And then my nurse is filming her at 7 o'clock the following morning, and she's showing off her brain power. My name is pretty hard to spell, so she spells it without hesitation, and then she spells it backwards. And most people can't spell it backwards, even having had no operation. So this technique really preserves the brain remarkably well. And it's because all of the metabolic processes of the body, that is the energy active processes, slow down as the body is cooled. And there's very, very little need for oxygen or glucose or blood flow of the brain at these low temperatures. And we use 18 degrees centigrade. So that's the nature of the technique, and I tell stories about a number of patients who've had operations under those conditions. One of them is a referee, a chief referee for the NFL, who makes these incredible calls, very insightful calls, after having had this type of operation.
And you answered my question about 18 degrees centigrade. I think it's worth pointing out that normal body temperature is 37 degrees centigrade, or what equals 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. So a body temperature of 18 centigrade is somewhere in the body temperature in the 60 degree range Fahrenheit, perhaps, or maybe even the low 50s, right?
Exactly.
So yes, we're talking about extremely cold. I mean, we're talking about certainly something that's got to be in a controlled setting, and quite fascinating. Is this the standard of care now for these aortic arch operations?
It's one of three options for those operations. There are two other options that have their own benefits and liabilities, but it has been the standard, and it's now used by 50% of experts in this field. We also tell the story of that frozen family. It was 20 years ago, 20-some years ago, and we had finished our first operations in the whole suite of cardiac surgery at Yale New Haven Hospital. And then one of my bosses at the time, I was still kind of wet behind the ears, one of my bosses got a call that a family had driven their van into the Connecticut River. This was a very, very cold New England wintry day. And that all the family members were in cardiac arrest, and the emergency room doctors wanted us to bring them in and put them on the heart-lung machine and warm them up. And so all the rooms were empty. We brought one family member into every room, and we warmed them up. And the children, the smallest ones, the smallest two, survived. The parents didn't survive, and the reason is that the smaller the individual's body is, the more rapid and the more efficient is the cooling from being in a frozen river. So the two young children, they were about 1 and 3, they survived. And they had some deficits. They weren't normal neurologically after such a dramatic submersion. And we sent them to rehab. And I never heard from them again. I didn't really expect a terrific outcome. But, of course, without a accepting them, the whole family would have been unequivocally gone. And then about 20 years later, John, I'm sitting at my desk, and my secretary buzzes in. I had just done an operation, big operation, and she's very excited. And she said, there's a young lady on the phone, and she wants to talk to you. And I said, well, what is it about? And she said, oh, you've got to talk to her yourself. And so I picked up the phone, and I recognized the name right away. And she said, I had some kind of surgery on my heart at Yale 20 years ago, and I'd like to know what it was. So she knew she had something, but how do you explain to someone now who's 23, 24 years old that she was dead after being submerged in ice-cold water, and we had warmed her up and revived her? And I was just appalled and flabbergasted in disbelief that she was well enough that she could be on the phone and was leading a normal life with a job and had finished school and sounded completely normal. And lo and behold, her brother was serving in the military. And this was just an incredible eye-opener for me, and it made me grateful that Dr. Hammond, my boss at that time, had made the decision for all of us to go ahead and warm up this family. And here suddenly there were two young adults alive because of that decision that he had made, and I guess a miracle of science that they could be put on the heart-lung machine to sustain their brains and their bodies while they were warmed.
You taught me something else in Extraordinary Hearts, your new book, about cooling and rewarming, and that is that once you've completed the operation after the deep freeze, so to speak, you don't want to rapidly rewarm the surgical patients, because if you do that, you literally stand a chance of cooking or denaturing, as it were, the proteins in their blood, the albumin, and you make the analogy to an egg white. And so it's something that has to be done very carefully and very slowly when you rewarm. So is it takes, you said it's hard for surgeons and hard for all medical people to play the waiting game. It takes some amount of time, doesn't it?
It does. And I wonder if I can convey the abrupt dichotomy. When you are on deep hypothermic arrest, every single second counts. Every stitch, every cut in your mind, the things you're considering are to get a watertight repair and to get it done quickly. Because although the brain is cold, you cannot stay there indefinitely. 40 to 50 minutes is the limit of the safe zone. So you are working. It's not feverishly. It's very controlled. And surgeons who do this know that if you're feverish and abrupt, it ends up not working as well and taking longer, actually. So it's very controlled, but every split second counts. And then the moment you're done with that and you resume the heart-lung machine and there's blood flowing again, you suddenly have 1 hour to do nothing and stand around and rewarm. And the reason is just what you stated, that the bloodstream is full of albumin. An egg white is made of albumin. It's a protein, a very nutritious protein, an important building block. And when the egg is in the shell, it's a liquid. But the moment you put it on the griddle, the protein changes shape, and that leads it to become a solid. So if we warm too rapidly, we'll have scrambled eggs in the bloodstream. And then those solid particles will go to the brain and other organs and just cause devastating injury. So we have to go very slowly, and it takes about 1 hour or longer to rewarm a normal-sized human. So we used to tell jokes during that time, and we'd give the medical students prizes for the best rewarming joke. But in this politically correct era, we've pretty much stopped doing that because there aren't too many jokes you can tell in a university environment that are politically correct. So we play music, and I quiz the students about their knowledge of 70s and 80s rock, and somehow we get through that period. But it's a very abrupt change. And if any of the listeners are familiar with Middle Eastern cooking, a really good cook, Middle Eastern cook, who's making something called egg lemon soup, a delicious chicken soup with egg flavor, knows that if she's hasty in warming after putting the egg in the mixture, it will curdle. So they know, they've learned this probably from many centuries ago, that they have to be patient and simmer very gradually, and that way the egg white will dissolve fully throughout the liquid soup and not form curdles. And if we rewarm too quickly, we would have those curdles in the bloodstream.
Your opening chapter is one that I think hooks readers right away. You relate the story of quite literally a miracle, and you use that word in, I would say, its dictionary definition. You don't mean it euphemistically. Emmy Shapiro had an unfortunate mishap during what was supposed to be a biopsy of a lymph node in her lung when accidentally one of the sharp surgical instruments punctured the left ventricle of her heart. And you describe how you were basically sitting down to, I guess, what's your usual lunch of a can of yogurt, and you didn't even get through the first bite, where you had to rush back and try to repair this ruptured heart. And you didn't give her much of a chance of not only, you know, surgical success, but even living really past the operation. So I was wondering if you could just share, I guess, some of the high points and the emotion of what happened in that case.
Yes, I'd be very pleased to share this fantastic anecdote that really opened my eyes to the possibility of a deeper layer behind everyday events. But like you said, I had no idea about this patient. I had never met her, and the surgeon who was performing this operation had this catastrophic event during the course of what was seemingly a relatively minor procedure. It shows us, John, what you and I know full well, that even a minor procedure has to be taken very seriously and can turn into a difficult or life-threatening problem. So when I walked into the room, it was like a scene out of MASH from a war zone. There was blood all over, and the drapes were disheveled because they had been pushed aside to make room for a much bigger incision than was planned initially. And everybody was shouting back and forth, and the anesthesiologist was shouting, he's a very experienced man, and that she's gone, you know, and why are we persisting? And it was so loud that even though they had called me, they didn't know that I was even in the room. And I made my way to the table and greeted my colleague there who'd had this complication. And it was hard to get facts because everybody was in a state of shock. But anyway, I could see the hole. Nothing was sterile. And you could see the drapes, and there were wires, non-sterile wires from the EKG going across the wound. But there was no pulse and no blood pressure, really. And I could see that we had to go on the heart-lung machine to have any chance of reviving this heart. So we did that. We went on the heart-lung machine. And then, as often happens when one is sewing heart muscle, the stitches that one puts in tear through the muscle. And our listeners may think of muscle as strong, and it is strong, it can generate power, but it's mushy, it doesn't hold stitches very well. So the repair stitches had torn through, and we had a big gaping hole like a gunshot wound in the tip, or what we call the apex of the left ventricle, the main pumping chamber of the heart. And I thought it was over, but I worked with my colleague. And I could see the relief on his face, and I've been in a similar position of having a friend help me during a difficult time. I could see the relief just to have someone dispassionate, not originally involved, but experienced helping out. And we put some stitches in there very carefully, neither of us expecting the stitches to hold for even a few minutes. But we put them in, and then we laid the heart down gingerly, and we never looked at it again. Normally, the dictum is that you have to inspect your repairs before you take the patient off the heart-lung machine to be sure they're secure. We were afraid that the mere act of lifting would disrupt the fragile equilibrium that we had achieved. And we tried to take the patient off the heart-lung machine, not expecting that heart to be able to generate any blood pressure on its own. And lo and behold, we had a couple beeps. And then with the beeps, we had a couple blips of blood pressure on the line that monitors the blood pressure. And before you knew it, we were off the heart-lung machine. And then we were afraid to even look at that area. We never looked at it again. We put a little surgical glue on there. And I never thought we'd get her closed, but we got her closed. And she was on powerful drugs to stimulate her heart, but then things held, and I left the room. And I never expected the patient really to get to the ICU. And she had a fine doctor as her primary surgeon, so I just finished my day, saw my patients, and went home. And I thought, well, should I call? And I thought, well, no, they would have called me to give me a report if she were still alive. And I thought it would be impossible that she really had made it to the ICU or was alive. And the following morning, I walked in to make rounds very early in the morning in the ICU, and Barbara Blanco, one of our nurses, grabbed me by the sleeve, and she said, Mrs. Solomon wants to talk to you. And I said, Barbara, you must have the wrong doctor. I don't have a patient by the name of Solomon. And she said, you better come with me. So I walked in the room, and she showed me a woman who was awake, off the respirator, animated. And she said, John, you know me. I've been to your house. And I didn't know who she was. Lo and behold, she was the woman from the day before. The repair had held. Her heart had worked well. She was off all the powerful drugs. By some miracle, she was awake after having been arrested for a long time, and she wasn't in shock from all the contamination. And to make a long story short, she's alive now. It's about 7 or 8 years later, and she was the teacher for my children. Both my children had her as a wonderful teacher. And this is the miracle part. Just the survival is absolutely miraculous and really doesn't fit with the medical facts. The chance of survival, I had placed at zero, really. But the miracle is that she and her family have dedicated their lives to the street children of Brazil. And they started a school for these children whose lives would otherwise be wasted. And they welcome every year 15 or 20 students, and they graduate them and they give them skills. And it's the most incredible place. And on our website, we have pictures of these children and of the school. So to me, I think that this woman was saved because of her dedication, her husband's dedication, and her family's dedication to her fellow human beings, which is off the scale in its intensity. I don't see any other reason why she would have survived all of this.
Dr. John Eleftheriades, I want to thank you so much for your time and congratulate you on the new book. It's called Extraordinary Hearts, just out from Berkeley, and I congratulate you on your success.
Thank you very, very much for the opportunity to share some of these stories, and thank you for your insightful questions and comments.
John Eleftheriades is the former chief of cardiothoracic surgery at Yale University and author of the new book, Extraordinary Hearts, just released from Berkeley. Well, that's our show for today. Studio Tulsa on Health is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views expressed on this program are those of our guests and do not reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.